Does Ohio's fracking industry pose a threat to groundwater? The oil and gas industry says no, but some oil well owners think otherwise. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss this question are Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you for having me on again.
And John Carroll University lecturer Ted Auk. Thanks for being here, Ted.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. Jake, you talked with landowners in southeastern Ohio who own hundreds of oil wells. Who are the Bobs and how much oil do their wells typically produce?
Yeah, the Bobs are two landowners. They both live in Washington County. One of the Bobs actually owns some land over in Athens County, but this is all in southeast Ohio. And like you mentioned, they own, I believe the number is 240 oil wells. I don't know how much they would produce, but now they are producing no oil or not enough oil to make economic sense for them because they are flooding out with this translucent, foul-smelling brine that they are attributing to some of the runoff that really leaking underground from these fracking injection wells. And the waste seems to be, at least according to the Bobs, and in seven cases, according to the state, leaking from these injection wells, which are almost trash silos very deep underground that house millions and millions of gallons of this waste from the fracking industry. And it seems to be leaking or migrating over into their oil wells, which just because of the pressure, the way pressure works when you're talking about things very deep underground, it's shooting up to the surface using these oil wells, the old-fashioned vertical kind, like a straw.
So instead of getting oil out of the ground, they're getting this salty, sludgy, briny stuff, huh?
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, if you think of oil, you know, like there will be blood-style oil, and you compare that to this, I mean, it's night and day. You know, the oil is thick and tar-like, and this stuff, you can see through it when it's in a jug. It's brown. It looks closer to dirty lake water more than anything resembling oil.
Ted, explain to us, what is an injection well? How do they work?
Right. So the injection wells that we're talking about here are the class two saltwater disposal injection wells. There's a whole class of injection wells. There's a variety of classes of injection wells, but the class two wells, and within that, the saltwater disposal wells are the ones that are taking in the waste in Ohio. And those are permitted by the ODNR's Underground Injection Control Program. And basically what they are, well, they're one of two things. They're either a repurposed oil well that's been repurposed to, instead of pull stuff out, take stuff in, in this case, brine, or they're, you know, newer wells that are permitted expressly for the purpose of injecting this brine that Jake is talking about from oil and gas operations deep underground into usually sandstone formations where the state of Ohio and the Ohio Geologic Survey says, you know, we have this formation underneath the ground that can basically sop up this waste forever, which, you know, as Jake has reported and others and myself at my former job at FracTrack, we all knew years ago, what goes down must come up, and we're seeing that in, you know, in some of these really dramatic events. But primarily an injection well, these injection wells are the reason we have so many of them in Ohio, and the reason that they're being permitted at such a rate in Ohio vis-a-vis West Virginia and Pennsylvania is that Ohio has primacy over our class two injection wells. That is to say, the DNR permits them, while Pennsylvania does not. US EPA has primacy over injection wells in PA. So we have a lion's share of the injection wells in Ohio. So we are servicing the three-state area when it comes to like disposing of oil and gas industries brine waste.
We're talking about whether Ohio's fracking industry poses a threat to groundwater. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Ted, can you just explain briefly what role these injection wells play in fracking? I mean, I'm not sure all of us are familiar with how that all works.
Right. So, and Jake pointed this out in his article, but what we found, and I used to work in an organization called FracTrack, where we did a lot of mapping and analysis of this very topic. And basically what we know is that the fracking industry, the unconventional oil and gas industry that descended on the Central Appalachia, you know, back in 2008 and 2009, you know, these wells are drilled down seven or 8,000 feet. And then the laterals, the L shape of these wells, goes out, you know, 10, 12, and now more recently, even 23,000 feet in length. So what they do is they drill these wells, or they drill these wells, and then they shove a whole bunch of water, sand, and chemicals down in them to what the industry calls frack the wells. That is to say, open up the shale seams so they can suck all the oil, the gas out of them. And they're primarily gas here in Ohio. And so what we know is that, like, these wells that we're talking about, they're using more and more water every single year. And that water, when it goes down, must come up. There's a strong correlation between how much water is used in the fracking process and how much brine comes up by way of that. And what we see is in Ohio and the two other states that I've looked at most extensively are that these wells, these unconventional wells, they are petering out. That is to say, their production is declining at a rapid clip. By the time they're 5 or 6 years old, they're not producing much of anything. But what they are continuing to produce and continue to produce about the same, if not more of, every single year is brine. So long after the gas is gone from these wells and stripped out of them, they're still producing a whole bunch of brine. And that has to go somewhere. And a lot of that stuff is going to injection wells, or maybe sometimes it's being repurposed or that kind of thing.
Jake, what kind of research has been done into whether the fracking industry has an impact on groundwater?
Yeah, well, I mean, to start, I'd go with what ODNR has done here, which maybe isn't research in the traditional sense, but they, in these seven instances, they're using two tells here. They're using pressure underground, and they're using some of the chemicals, some of the actual substances they're seeing. But they have managed to track from point A to point B, point A being an injection well and point B being a production well, sometimes 5 miles away. They are definitively concluding that brine is migrating. They use the term migrating. I like the term leaking, but leaking from one to the other. And I think that has been established pretty thoroughly. There are specifics in the article, but other states, other researchers have identified this problem before, where there's more uncertainty, but a lot of anxiety, especially in these communities, is around water. You know, the general line of thinking going, okay, we know that this stuff is migrating underground from point A to point B, with point B being a production well, but who's to say that doesn't get to point C, an aquifer? And in some of these cases, like even in Washington County, one of these new wells that was recently permitted, and that's a new well going to an operator who has previously owned wells that have been found to be leaking, that operator has sited an injection well about 4 and 3 miles from two aquifers in the area. So there's a lot of consternation, not a lot of evidence of it actually happening yet, but just the feeling being it's just a matter of time until it does happen. And by that, I mean reach water. And I'd add here that a water authority in the area that's, you know, the people that deliver 2,500 people in Washington County their water, they are very worried about this. They are calling state regulators. They are calling lawmakers. They are trying to bring a lot of attention to this issue. Because they're saying, and you could look down on this as simple logic, but they're saying it's a simple thing. Something is flowing underground. It's reached the wells. Who's to say it won't reach the water?
I want to note that we did invite Ohio's Oil and Gas Association to join us on the program today. They were not able to join us, but we got a statement from the association that reads, "It is important to note that no drinking water has been compromised in the state due to oil and gas injection wells." We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Robert. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just want to thank you for bringing this issue to attention. And my question is more towards the legislators of why are we, given how precious groundwater is, and given the increasing climate crisis of water scarcity that's going to be just getting worse and worse with the decades, why are we playing with Ohio's groundwater like this? Why are we willing to take any risk at all to our groundwater? It's just so silly to me and scary.
Well, thank you, Robert. Jake, have you talked with Ohio lawmakers about that question? I know we don't have any Ohio lawmakers on the program today to address that directly.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. And I'd add, I was just talking about the Water Authority. There was a lawmaker, Tristan Rader, who is a Democrat in the Ohio House, who did come down and listen to all this. And he really seemed interested. And, you know, he sits in a caucus that serves, I think holds 33 or 34 of 99 seats. So not a whole lot of political power, but he was there in the room. I'd add what I mentioned earlier, that there was an operator who just had a well permitted near an aquifer, has operated other injection wells that has leaked. The former CEO of that company is a man named Brian Chavez, who was, until he became a senator, the CEO of a company called Deep Rock Disposal Solutions. He is now the Senate Energy Chairman. So while he's no longer the CEO of Deep Rock, this is someone who has long worked in the natural gas industry, who was a principal operator here, and who actually was involved in a pretty entrenched legal effort to avoid $1.3 million in remediation costs. So, and I'd add one other note about a lawmaker is there was a consternation at this meeting that Tristan Rader, the Democrat, attended, that they couldn't get Kevin Ritter, who is the state representative of the area, to attend the meeting. I did reach out to Kevin Ritter, and he declined to comment and said, I trust ODNR to handle this issue. So I'd say there's not a whole lot of attention coming from lawmakers, and of, you know, the limited amount of political engagement that this water authority was able to get. They're saying, well, ODNR has the engineers, ODNR has the geologists. I'm just going to go with ODNR here.
Ted, can I say something about that?
Yeah, please do.
About ODNR.
And that's the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, just for.
Right, correct. Yeah. And then within that is the Underground Injection Control Program, which is the one responsible for Class 2 wells. Ohio got primacy over injection wells back in the early 80s. And no one could have foreseen what they were dealing, you know, no one could have foreseen the fracking revolution that was, you know, that came ashore back in 2008. The other thing is, and so I would argue that Ohio probably shouldn't have primacy over its injection wells, because regardless of what's going on in DC, the primacy process more broadly tends to slow the permitting process of injection wells, and it puts the onus on other states to deal with their waste rather than to bring it across state lines. So I think that's a big issue, which is the primacy that Ohio has and really has demonstrated it can't really manage. But I would also say that with respect to DNR, there's a lot of really good people that are working at these agencies. They are just outgunned and outmanned and womaned. Like, they just don't have the resources, the know-how, or their headcounts to like manage what they've been forced to deal with. If you look at the amount of inspectors that are within the DNR's UIC program, and then you look at the amount of injection wells that have been permitted over time, these folks are being charged with looking after more and more stuff with less and less people. And that is why you get what Jake reported on here. Or that's a reason why you get what Jake reported on here, is you have a lot of people on the ground that just don't have the resources and just the number of people to do the jobs that they're tasked with doing. And it's a classic example. We're seeing it in Washington right now. Strip these agencies of their headcount, of the resources, and then all of a sudden you can point to them as being agencies that aren't doing their job, which they're not. But I mean, there's something to be said for the fact that they haven't been allowed to do or empowered to do the work that they need to do.
Ted, let me ask you this. We've talked about how there isn't exactly direct evidence that groundwater has been contaminated by fracking, but there's a lot of concern. If groundwater does get contaminated, what are the implications? What would that mean for wildlife, for drinking water?
I mean, I think the state of Ohio, and for example, I don't think Jake talked about them in the article, but the Muskingum Watershed Conservancy District, which is an agency, kind of I call it a rogue agency, but it's an autonomous agency that's tasked with managing the water within the Muskingum Watershed. If you look at them as an example, and I'll get to your question, I don't think that we are looking at water holistic to the last caller's question. We are not looking at the watershed and the water cycle within Ohio in a way that makes any long-term sense. We're viewing water as this kind of fungible commodity that where we should maximize the profit that we can get from it. And with respect to well water, I mean, there's a reason why you have so many people in Noble County and Guernsey County, Monroe, Belmont County with these big water jugs, you know, adjacent to their homes. Either they are just worried that their water has been contaminated, or, you know, companies have just been providing these to them to allay any of their fears. I think that's kind of a canary in the coal mine, is how many of these things you see down there. And I think it speaks to the fact that so many people are on well water, and there's the great unknown happening 7,000 feet below us, and it's a bunch of Swiss cheese. And I just think that there's just so much communication happening between geologies and between wells that, you know, it really does worry me what's happening to well water. And the problem that I have is that the DNR, once again, the DNR does not have in place a rigorous, long-term, methodical way of collecting data on the whether and how many wells have been compromised to the extent that they have. And so really what we're dealing with is a large data unknown to answer your question.
Jake, the Bobs, these men we talked about at the start of this conversation, they drove to Columbus to ask state lawmakers for help. What kind of reception did they get?
Yeah, they did come to Columbus. One thing I just want to add, I think might give people a little bit of a sense of perspective here, just some basic numbers. One that comes from the industry is in a given fracking well, you need about 4 million gallons of water to extract gas from it. And in the year 2024, this number comes from ODNR, there were 1.38 billion gallons, billion with a B, that were permitted for injection. And a little ChatGPT math here says that that's more than 2,096 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So those are 25 by 50 meters, 2,000 of them in a year. So that's the scale of what we're talking about. And to your question about the Bobs, they came down, you know, there are a lot of parliamentary rules at the State House about what you can address, and generally comments can't be directed personally at members. They must be germane to the bill. And sometimes there are artful interpretations of what is and what is not germane. But the Bobs came down ostensibly to testify about a bill that would give Ohio the same primacy that Ted was talking about, would give Ohio that primacy on carbon dioxide injection, which is really a whole nother animal, but it's the same concept of just storing this industrial waste underground. And the chairman, Don Jones, or the ex-lawmaker, I should say, Don Jones now, he pretty aggressively shouted both of them, not shouted, pretty aggressively told both of them they were out of line, you're out of lane. And, you know, he was right. They weren't commenting about the bill. They were really talking about a bigger issue. But on the other hand, these are constituents talking about a very serious public policy problem. These are people who have had, you know, these hundreds of thousands of dollars in financial assets being damaged by almost defective products of injection wells. So, you know, if you want to be a stickler for the rules, you could say the committee chairman was right to call them, say their testimony was non-germane. But the end result was two, you know, just old men, normal people. These aren't lobbyists. These aren't political insiders. These are just people who came to talk to lawmakers about a problem they're having, were really shouted down.
So, Jake, what can Ohio residents do if they're worried about fracking near their land or even on their land? What can they do? What rights do they have under state law? Can they file suit to try to, you know, bring about change if they're worried about this?
Well, so that the Bobs have filed lawsuits, and the lawsuits are interesting because they most of their evidence is really what ODNR found. And ODNR pretty definitively said one particular injection well, the Redbird number 4 well, leaked and damaged, I believe it's 28 or maybe 50 of their wells, but at dozens of their wells. And they filed a lawsuit against not just Redbird, but other injection wells, some of which have been found by ODNR to be leaking, some of which haven't had that finding against them. And it has ping-ponged through the courts and is now at the Ohio Supreme Court. Specifically, a trial judge granted the injection well operators motions to dismiss the case. And those arguments were essentially, well, you can't prove that it's our injection waste that flooded their wells. You know, it could be anyone's. Who says it's even injection waste? A trial judge bought the argument. Appellate judges did not. The question is now to the Ohio Supreme Court. But I'm very keenly watching this case because if you think about it, the problems that the Bobs are having and trying to find, you know, our legal system is individualistic. You need to prove that you're injured and you need to prove that a specific party caused your injury. If they fail to do this here, where they seem to have been legitimately injured and there seems to be evidence that at least one party that they named is the source of that injury, what's going to happen if an aquifer is contaminated? Then, you know, the state or whatever government draws water from that aquifer would be the injured party. If the Bobs can't get liability out of this, what's going to happen when the state says we just had to pay X number of millions of dollars here to fix this problem and we want someone else to pay?
Yeah.
Jake, have the injection well owners talked with you about any of this as part of your reporting?
No, almost uniformly no. Brian Chavez, who just by virtue of me being a State House reporter was the easiest for me to physically access, he did not respond to questions I sent to him. We spoke briefly before a floor session, and he wasn't interested in being interviewed. And to his credit, he is the part, you know, that he is personally named in this lawsuit. So not always the best idea to talk about active litigation. I reached out to, I think there are about 10 parties named in that lawsuit. Virtually none of them responded. In just researching them, one of these operators literally has the injection well listed for sale on Facebook. One of the parties has gone underwater and is now, there's a trustee or a receiver, which is just like a court-appointed lawyer in charge of distributing their assets, who has tried to give this faulty injection well back to ODNR, and ODNR is claiming they have no mechanism to take it. So it's pretty hard to find these parties. It's pretty hard to even bring them to any kind of account of what do you say to what ODNR is claiming your well did.
Mm-hmm. Well, and giving a well to ODNR, would that basically require the state to pay for cleaning it up if there's a problem?
Yes. And that's a very expensive proposition. And there's a lot of state and federal money that goes toward those kinds of well cleanups.
Yeah, I was just going to say about the give. I think you even had give in quotes in your article. The give back to the state is a give back to the taxpayer. And I think one thing to your question about like what can residents do, we need, when you have hearings about this kind of stuff or when you have meetings at the Ohio Oil and Gas Land Management Commission or some of these, it's the same 40 or 50 people that show up to these meetings. So we do need to kind of spread the word that people need to start to pay attention. And as far as giving back to the state these wonderful assets, yes, the plugging of these things is a non-trivial task. And I think that the state of Ohio, I think right now what they're using as an assumption for what it costs to plug a well, an injection well, is like $65,000 or $75,000 per well. But we know, because we have data from North Dakota, for something like 300 wells through what they got a bunch of money through the CARES Act, that actually saltwater disposal wells, when you include reclamation of the site and actual plugging, they can cost upwards of $450,000 to $500,000 per well. So these are larger numbers.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman and John Carroll University lecturer Ted Auk. Thank you both so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.